Abortion and the Christian voter. That's our topic for this segment on Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and our guest is Robert Schwarzwalder, who's the director for Regent University of the Center for Christian Thought and Action. Their website is centerforchristianthoughtandaction.org. He's a senior lecturer at Regent. He's also written some columns, and he is the former senior vice president for the Family Research Council. I'm Jerry Newcomb. This is Vocal Point. Rob, it's great to have you back on the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Jerry, it's really my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's
sure.
Good to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. And I saw a headline with, I thought it was a column you had written, but I guess it was just a response. But the phrase was abortion and the single issue voter. Now, here we are around, this is being recorded around the time of election 2020, but I want to, again, make this talk as so generic. We can listen to this, you know, 5 years from now, and it'd still be relevant because the issue of abortion is not going to go away and the voting is not going to go away. But what about this single issue voter? Is that a responsible Christian position to have, especially when it comes to the issue of abortion?
You know, it's a great question, Jerry. There is no denial that there are other issues that are critical. We look at things that are taking place with respect to race in America, the denigration of the family, the erosion of marriage, threats to religious liberty. Yet all of these things can be addressed in a period of time or in various elections by public persuasion. The reality is abortion is about death, and there's nothing more final than the destruction of human life. So in my own view, we have to think very carefully about the things that matter most. Jesus spoke about the weightier issues of the law. What could be more weighty than preying on a woman who's in a crisis pregnancy and then her allowing her unborn child to be destroyed? This is what the abortion industry does. It's what takes place in abortion itself, and it's something that should deeply concern people who love God and believe that He is the maker of man in His image and likeness.
I'm Christian, and I'm pro-life, but so often you hear some people say, what is your response when you hear that kind of line, that opening?
Well, yeah, it concerns me because we should be Christian, period. We need to simply have a deep commitment to Christ that transcends any other loyalty or allegiance, whether it's to party or anything else. And when we think about the things that we are concerned with in our country and how we're going to vote, we need to have the values that God does. Now, I'm quick to add, Jerry, I realize that not everyone agrees with the position I'm taking. Some of them see a number of other issues as of equal importance. Some people that you and I know and respect will say public civility is as important as the right to life, for example. I would simply say many issues are important to the Christian voter. It's a question of, do any rise above the rest in terms of immediacy and seriousness? When we think about the sanctity of human life, every day, at least 2,000 unborn children in our country are aborted, either through surgical or chemical abortions. Overall, we've seen more than 60 million unborn lives destroyed in the womb. Second, so that's an immediate problem. It's a daily thing. The second thing is it serious? Well, self-evidently, we have done grave damage to the dignity of human life in our country. Women have been exploited by the abortion industry. They have been encouraged to make a choice as though it's a choice between, say, Coke and Pepsi, when in fact it's a choice between life and death. So we have to look at these things in terms of what is most important. And I do think that as we consider our votes, we have to look at the things that are closest to the heart of God. We remember Satan is described by Jesus as a liar and a murderer from the beginning. These kinds of things are imperative for us as we consider the issues of priorities in voting. And I don't think that we can in any way dismiss the seriousness of how abortion deals with, or rather how our culture deals with abortion.
You know, it's so interesting. You said a moment ago that every day there are 2,000 unborn babies whose lives are snuffed out. You've been in this fight a long time. So have I. It used to be that we would say every day 4,000 lives are unborn lives are snuffed out. There has been progress, and most people don't realize it, but that progress is because of various state laws in most cases that restrict this type of abortion or that type of abortion because they're just so barbaric. Even pagan people would say, oh, yeah, no, you can't have that. You know, even partial birth abortion in its second iteration passed the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, you know, the Supreme Court, which is upholding, unfortunately, or has upheld Roe v. Wade, but they said, no, that's too much. So there has been progress.
Yeah, there has been progress. And as you say, much of it has been done at the state level. Things like ultrasound legislation requiring women to see the unborn child in the womb, the waiting periods, abortion center regulations, other things like this that have had a very positive effect. And so some abortion has been reduced, and yet we're still seeing it on a widespread scale. And as we think about politicians who come and go and so forth, we have to take a good look when we're in that voting booth actually casting a ballot, who is going to defend the most defenseless among us, the unborn. A friend of, I think, yours and mine, Ryan Bomberger, who is himself African-American, and I were at a conference a few years ago, and Ryan at one point said this, would anybody in the 1860s have said that slavery was not the single most pressing issue of our time? Similarly, he said, does anybody or should anybody who claims the name of Christ dispute that the destruction of unborn human life is the most important issue today? And it's a rhetorical question that it invites its own answer. We have seen a chipping away at the edifice of abortion, and yet we haven't seen ultimate victory. And in fact, in the state where I live, Virginia, the current governor has lifted, with the help of the state legislature, has lifted the mandatory viewing of ultrasound photographs. He has lifted the 24-hour waiting period between the time a woman says she wants an abortion and the time she can obtain it. And so these things are piecemeal. They're welcome, but they're not permanent. We need a Supreme Court that will have the honesty, the integrity to say Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton were wrongly decided, and we need to look at what the Constitution says. The states before Roe versus Wade had a patchwork of laws and regulations. They were working things out. Many of those laws and regulations we would disagree with, but this fundamentally is a state issue, which is why we need a federal ruling from the Supreme Court to say there is no constitutional right to have an abortion. And that will be a decisive moment in our nation's history.
You know, what's so interesting, too, is we're recording this in late October. Recently, we saw Amy Coney Barrett, who has been nominated to the Supreme Court, and she was asked specifically about Roe v. Wade, and she made a distinction between precedent and super precedent. I don't know if you happen to hear about that or even just hear about the argument itself, but I thought that was profound. She was putting Roe v. Wade in the category of precedent. She was putting, let's say, Brown v. Board of Education, which dealt with, prejudiced schools or whatever, separate but equal schools, which, by the way, I once talked to Phyllis Schlafly, and we were talking about the subject of judicial activism, and I said, some people have said Brown versus Board of Education was an example of judicial activism. You know what she said? She said, no, Brown versus Board of Education corrected a poor decision called Plessy versus Ferguson, which was an example of judicial activism. What Brown did was correct the mistake of, you know, half a century before of judicial activism. Here's the bottom line, though. There's a difference between precedent and super precedent. I thought that was really profound of Judge Barrett.
Yeah, I think it's a very thoughtful distinction. And also, we have to look, whether you call it a super precedent or ordinary precedent, here's the deal. When the Supreme Court rules inaccurately, it needs to be changed. Take, for example, the 1857 Dred Scott decision, which explicitly said no black man has any rights that a white man needs to respect. That was horrible morally. It was also thoroughly unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, we ended up with a not only the Emancipation Proclamation, but the 13th and the 14th Amendments that essentially said people of color are human beings. The Supreme Court was wrong. And similarly, whether it's super president, as Judge Barrett articulated, or whether it's simply a more traditional precedential ruling, we can't allow things that are bad law remain as continuing policy. And I think there's another point here to make, Jerry, which is the Supreme Court was never intended to be the arbiter of these decisive and divisive questions. That's the job of the legislature. The job of the court is to call balls and strikes, as it were. And I think that in people like Justice Alito, Justice Thomas, Judge Barrett, there are others who are deeply committed to interpreting the Constitution based on its original meaning and its clear textual meaning as well. And so when we have a situation where people want to stretch the law into like this elastic shape, what we're seeing really is the abandonment of our constitutional order. The reason we have a written constitution was that our founders wanted to make sure we would not become like Britain, where there is no written constitution and the monarch at that time and now Parliament can make law extemporaneously. They wanted a constitution that both defines and constrains government. And I think what really terrifies the left is having a federal judiciary that interprets the Constitution as it was written. And the founders, by the way, gave us a couple ways of changing the Constitution through the amendment process, which we've done more than 20 times, but also the Bill of Rights explicitly says anything not given in this Constitution to the federal government is reserved to the states and to the people. In other words, we've said what we want government to do and be, period. Anything else, get it done at the state level. That's an imperative that we have long forgotten and that I hope a new federal judiciary is beginning to restore.
All right, get back to the issue of civility. Okay, you said that there are some Christians who, let's say, take the example of Donald Trump, okay? Some people get turned off by him, even professing Christians, because he, can be a boor, or they think, or, bully or something like that. But in the meantime, they would rather vote for somebody who's nice but who's committed to the pro-abortion, whereas Donald Trump has a good track record, really, from a pro-life perspective, of putting in good judges and standing up for the sanctity of life. Civility versus life.
Well, yeah, I do think that all Christians should be troubled by some of the things President Trump has said and done. There's no question that at times he has been very crude, very accusatory, very demeaning. Those are things that are troubling, and we shouldn't gloss them over. He also has a personal history that is very questionable, and understandably, many Christians are concerned about that. I think we have to look, though, at something that Richard Neuhouse, the founder of First Things Journal, once called the ethics of consequences. What will be the results? I've always taught my own children, ends don't justify means. There are times when there are no good options, and if you have to make a decision, you have to take the least bad. As you say, some of President Trump's opponents are much more civil, they're much more conventional, they're much more gracious, they have led less controversial lives. But the policies they would enact would do grave damage, not only to the unborn, but to our country at large. And
okay,
I do think
10
we
seconds.
Have to look at that.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, thank you so much, Rob Schwarzwalder. Again, the website is Center for Christian Thought and Action.org. All the best. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.